Welcome to Coast to Cast, a podcast on coastal science where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published papers. With this podcast, we want to give voices to many coastal scientists and engineers so we can meet them, at least virtually, and hear curious and less curious questions. My name is Ana Vila Concejo, and today I am having a chat with Andy Green, who is Professor of Marine Geology at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And this research interest includes geomorphology, sedimentology, and stratigraphy of coastal and marine environments. He's only the second researcher based in Africa that we have interviewed for this podcast, so I'm really looking forward to learning about the different intricacies of coastal research in South Africa. Hello, Andy. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So Giovanni and I started this podcast in 2021. It was sort of a response to the lockdowns and the lack of traveling and contact that we had with COVID. And COVID incidence was particularly high in South Africa, or at least this is what the international press told us. Can you tell us just briefly how COVID affected your life and your research?
So COVID particularly impactful on my life, just from a personal side of things, just as we welcomed our firstborn 2 weeks before that very big lockdown that happened across the globe. So we had this small newborn trying to juggle the idea of not being able to get out, no family support or any other form of support network to step in. So that was particularly difficult, as well as that transition then to all of this isolation and online teaching and a change in terms of just how we go about, I suppose, interacting with the world. It was a tough one personally. Work-wise, I think I'm probably echoing what almost everybody said. It was just a complete and abrupt halt to almost every activity that we had planned. Big research projects ground to a halt. We couldn't go out in terms of chartering ships just because you weren't allowed to have so many people in close proximity. So, you know, a lot of flexible thinking with regards to research had to come about because of the situation. You know, we had to invent new research projects, be a lot more flexible in how we, I guess, proceed ahead with managing things like postgraduate students, you know, so a very big change. But I think in many ways, not completely negative, a lot of positives to come too in terms of that flexibility.
I like ending with a positive, full of the COVID stories. I think it was somehow educational, if only about how we were and how we reacted. Okay, let's go to the questions. So as you know, we mix science questions with a little bit of personal questions in this podcast, and we'll try to keep it to 30 minutes. So I will start now with the first question, which is, how did you start in coastal science?
So I'm an import to the coast. I was born in Zimbabwe, which is a landlocked country. And I think my first visit to the ocean was probably about 2 or 3 years old, maybe a little older. And it was extremely exciting. I found the ocean the most fantastic and amazing thing I'd ever seen. And when we moved here from Zimbabwe, that was in the early to mid 1980s, I just fell in love with the sea. I've loved surfing. Just something about it has always attracted me. I'd initially started studying then as a geographer and a geologist. So I did full geography and geology as my two majors at university. And in that, I'd intended to become a meteorologist. The reason being, surfing and winds and understanding the weather patterns was just so intrinsically related to, you know, my life and my behavior. I mean, I would constantly be glued to the window looking at which way the palm tree was blowing in my parents' garden in case the wind had turned offshore. So that was what I wanted to do. But as it went on, I'd started my fourth year at university and my project wasn't quite that exciting. It was about tropospheric, stratospheric ozone exchange, which you can imagine is somewhat dry. And I changed at the last second, and I did a project relating to wind patterns and dune formation along the coast, forming blowouts in these big parabolic dune systems. And I think it was at that point I was really hooked. And then I realized I could marry my love of the coast and the ocean with some of the stuff I'd learned as a geologist, and I never looked back. So basically, I am here today on almost on a whim. I only study geology because of a band that I really liked when I was younger called Bad Religion. The lead singer's it's a punk band, and the lead singer's a geologist. And I remember getting one of their CDs back in the day when, you know, there were CDs and cassettes out, and reading the liner notes on that cassette, actually. And there were all these cool quotes by this guy, James Hutton. And I was like, what on earth is this all about? And I started to dig, and basically that's how I studied geology and eventually found my way through this winding path to where I am today. So, you know, forever grateful for the flexibility of my parents allowing me to do all of these unusual changes in my life.
That is very interesting. I used to like Bad Religion as well, and I didn't know that. That is good. I like to learn. Okay, the next question, and someone as a father of young children, how do you balance your life commitments, personal and work? Can you do it?
So it's an interesting question. My first and perhaps more cynical response would be, it's impossible, but you have to, of course. So I think in many ways that the life commitments are family commitments. So it's your commitments to your kids and of course to your spouse to make sure that, you know, things are operating well at home. And then the other big commitment is of course to service work, which doesn't leave a lot of your commitment to yourself. But, you know, I think at the moment with two little kids, it's just a passing phase. With balancing things, I've had to be quite brutal in that the family is everything around work hours. So work starts at 8 and it ends at 4, and there's just nothing that can impinge on that. So unfortunately, there are many days where things don't get done and they roll on and they roll on, and you build up a giant list of things that need to be dealt with. But I think I've taken to the idea that work is work. It's not a vocation. As much as I love the coast and the ocean and the research of things, I do need to realize that it is a paycheck that's helping me to provide for my family. And so, you know, the family comes first. And the nice thing is that my wife is also an academic. She's also a geologist. In fact, her office is just almost directly across from mine at work. And she's brutal when it comes to timekeeping. She's far more organized than I am. And basically, she's like, okay, it's 4 o'clock time. And, you know, the computer gets switched off and that's it. I feel very guilty if I have to answer an email or do any sort of late night administration. And I think, you know, for the last two and a half years, it's actually worked quite well. So I'm very grateful for her militant time policing skills.
That's good. That's good. I mean, the other thing is that you have had your children, both of them, after COVID. So you are living a different life and will hopefully get better. But I think that keeping your time and so on is probably a good idea. And it's good that your wife is there to keep you on your toes.
So, you know, just thinking about it, Anna, the best part of this has been, you know, and I think the most overwhelming positive out of COVID has been that it has allowed me to balance to some degree work and family. So having been at home, there's been few disruptions other than family disruptions. You know, it's not like the same as sitting in an office and you get inundated with people passing through. And so, you know, I've been able to, at least in that sense, focus on things better. But at the same time, I've got to watch my eldest grow up. Well, he's only 2 and a half, so not yet quite grown up. But, you know, I've been here in a way in which I think few fathers have gotten the opportunity to be there with their kids. Likewise, too, it's been 4 months now with my second son. And I've really, really felt that I've had a chance to form a very close connection that hasn't been completely overprinted by work. You know, in the absence of being at home, I've got to be here. I've got to do all of the things that, you know, you would normally do if you were a mother on maternity leave. And I just feel it's been great balancing out things between my wife and I, you know, and to really kind of try and push to be equal parents as opposed to this, you know, unusual notion that, you know, the wife stays at home and does whatever and the man goes out and does the breadwinning. It's really been a very good experience, and that has been fantastic. So, you know, there have been positives to COVID. The negatives, I'd say, obviously do outweigh the positives. But for me, this has been, you know, a thing that I don't recall much of what the last 2 years have brought, but they've really brought a lot of family happiness, which I think is, you know, paramount
and very important too. Okay, continuing with the non-research questions. What are your interests or hobbies? What do you like to do when you're not working?
Well, at the moment, I think my principal hobby is sleep. So I'll try and catch up and sleep whenever I can. But I've always loved surfing. I love bodyboarding and surfing, anything to do with the ocean, even if it was to go for a quick swim. We live very close to the ocean, so we're very lucky in that respect. So even with the juggle of things, I've tried as much as I can to get down to the beach as much as possible. So that has always been, and for 25 years, if not more, one of the key focal points in my life. Love to play a bit of guitar, enjoy playing tennis. My brother-in-law and I play tennis just around the corner here at the country club, have a beer or two. Also like to meet up with friends and have a cold beverage around the holidays. But I'm a simple guy. I enjoy really listening to music. And I suppose as a parent, you tend to forget what your hobbies are, but I'm pretty sure those are my hobbies, I think.
Okay, so our area of research has a, in general, has a nice culture. Like we're quite a friendly bunch, and equity, diversity. I think we all think is important. What would you change in our culture, in our area of research, to make it a better place?
Now, I think on the international scale of things, it's a fantastic culture, and I think it's very open and warm. People know each other. I don't think it's a very big field relative to some of the other fields that I guess I'm exposed to as a geologist, as opposed to a geographer or a geomorphologist. But at the end of the day, it's extremely open and inviting. So there are massive positives to that. I think that perhaps on the local scale of things, there are, very few of us that do this kind of work in South Africa. So it's become quite unusual that you have other people picking up bits and pieces. So you have biologists doing work in coastal geomorphology or geology, oceanographers, that sort of thing. And what that tends to do is it actually doesn't create a very wholesome environment. It creates a bit of a fractured environment. And the opportunity is there for people to build their own kingdoms, which is not conducive, I think, to pushing science forward, particularly here in Africa, where this is a critically underrepresented field of research and field of study. I think, if I could change it, I'd change the fact that it would be helpful to have a little bit more cohesion here in the local scale of things, working towards a broader aim with the people that are working in this field, as opposed to this sort of relatively fractured system that is in place. And the system itself is somewhat poorly funded here because it's completely overlooked. So you'll see if you look at any syllabus for any of the universities, at least in South Africa, but I've also looked at this across the whole continent. There are no courses in things like coastal marine geology, coastal marine geomorphology. It's very few universities offer this. In fact, our university is the only one that does. And so that too would be something I would really, really hope to see emerging, is that there'd be more academics brought on. It's critical. I mean, it's the fact that so many urban centers live or are created along the coast, and we know that the coast is such threatened areas, and yet this is something that is fundamentally understaffed and undertaught across all of our postgraduate, or sorry, all of our higher education institutions. It really is, it's alarming. Internationally, I don't know. There's nothing I'd really want to change. I just find it's so refreshing compared to the local scene. It's so vibrant, whereas I feel very much alone and isolated here. Perhaps it would be something that I would like to see happen in the future, would be perhaps more cross collaboration with people from around the world, but also cross collaboration, not where people come inwards to South Africa because it's an unknown place, but where South African scientists are also going and doing research elsewhere on an equal standing with other scientists from, Australia or the UK or the US or wherever it might be. So I think maybe that would be the one thing I'd like to see change. But on the whole, I've just found it a very positive and rewarding place to be in terms of community. It's fantastic.
Can't you tell us, we're going back to science, can't you tell us about your favorite paper or a paper that changed your life?
So this is an unusual paper because this isn't really a paper on coastal geomorphology or coastal geology. But when I was a student, I read this paper by a guy called Preston Cloud. It's from the 1960s, and it was about stromatolites and how stromatolites were, these first organisms to form in the Archean, the early Earth, and were the fundamental drivers of producing our atmosphere. And I just remember thinking to myself that it's just the most miraculous and ingenious thing ever. I think this is just the coolest thing that somebody actually managed to think of this, or to decipher that this was the case. I thought that was really one of the most prescient and clever things I'd ever read. And I mean, I don't think it inspired me necessarily to become a coastal geologist, but I thought that was just something fantastic. In terms of, say, coastal geology, a friend of mine, John Goff, he's at the University of Texas. He sent me a paper he'd written on incised valley systems. And I'd never heard of these things before because, we don't, prior to my joining university, there was just no marine geology or coastal geology ever taught. And this incised valley system paper, I just thought was the coolest thing. You have these buried river valleys, and then they have all of the sediment stuck in them. And they can tell you everything you'd like to know about how sea levels transgress and how coastlines change as these things move over, because those are the only real bits of sediment that are preserved during that process. And it tickled my fancy so much that to this day, I still, and that was in 2006, I think. So that was when I was a PhD student. To this day, I still regard that as one of the most interesting papers I've ever read from my actual field of things and a field of research I'm still very interested in.
Can you briefly explain one of your topics of research to our listeners? You can choose one.
Just one. Okay. Let me think. Let me think. I'm a terrible, and that's what happens when you live in Africa. You don't become a specialist in one individual thing. You are pretty much a jack of all trades by the fact that you are forced to be. So you have to be a coastal geomorphologist. You have to be a stratigrapher. You have to know geophysics. You have to know all of these sorts of things because you are really operating in a very, very tiny, tiny space relative to manpower. So my field of study is very broad. I'm a coastal geomorphologist. I'm a stratigrapher. I'm a marine geologist. I like to do geophysics, but I like to use all of those together. And the fundamental thing is, I like to examine relict coastal features that are left behind on the shelf. So, oftentimes submerged shorelines or drowned shorelines, and how these shorelines relate to sea level forcing and to antecedent geological forcing. And also how these shorelines can allow us to reconstruct paleo sea levels. So I have a very keen interest in drawing parallels between the modern, so the actual contemporary geomorphological systems that we see along coasts, and then what we see in the past, so throughout the Pleistocene and into the Holocene. So I have a very, very keen interest in trying to integrate spatial and timescales between these sorts of things.
Very good. You managed to do it very briefly, Andy. Yes. You have done field work in amazing places. What are the wildest field conditions that you have encountered?
Wildest conditions and the worst conditions are sometimes the closest, but I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'll elaborate on the worst and then on the wildest, if that's okay. So I think the absolute worst conditions that we've ever had to do fieldwork, and we had this big water research commission project. It was to understand the evolution of coastal water bodies along the northern coast of South Africa, going up towards the Mozambican border. And so these water bodies are quite interesting because they house sediments over the last, say, 8,000 years. It can give us an idea of climate reconstructions. They're just also interesting in terms of understanding how these monstrous bodies of water have evolved along the coast. They're all situated within a UNESCO World Heritage Site, so it's very beautiful. And with that, of course, comes some of the wildlife challenges that we are exposed to here in Africa. So out of this project, both I think the worst and the most wildest conditions have arisen. The worst being our first field trip. It was in the middle of summer. It was the end of January, and the end of January along the east coast of South Africa is an unpleasant time to be anywhere. It's extremely hot, it's extremely humid, lots of rainfall, and with that comes mosquitoes and all of the other horrible animals that associate with that. So we stayed in the place where first it said it was rustic accommodation. So I'm thinking, okay, you know, like this boutique rustic style is going to be cool log cabins, but like, you know, reasonable kitchen, there'll be electricity. I checked. No, there's electricity for sure. So we all brought along little fans to keep us cool at night. No, we get there and potentially rustic, I think, was a kind term. Prehistoric might have been perhaps a more fitting description of where we were staying. So we get in there, there's no electricity. There's a chest freezer that just freezes things. So everything had to get frozen as opposed to just neatly chilled. So the beers were consistently warm, which is horrendous. You know, you want that cold beer after a long day of getting sunburnt and bitten by horseflies. Then where we slept, we were basically, you know, I think there must have been something akin to a medieval dungeon. They looted something out of somewhere in the United Kingdom and then brought them into South Africa for beds. And they had mosquito nets, but the mosquito nets didn't keep the mosquitoes out. They just kept them in. So it was so bad that you couldn't put fans on. And honestly, these mosquitoes are basically pterodactyl-like. They're these enormous things. You would just wake up and you'd slap your face and you'd probably get like 5 or 6 mosquitoes in one slap. It was so bad that, you know, essentially you would put, you know, like the anti, what is it, the stuff with the DEET stuff, DEET, that's what the guys call it. You'd put that spray on you to try and keep them off. It just wouldn't. I think it was like a delicious coating for them. You know, it was like a marinade. So eventually we'd go and buy that really strong stuff that like you'd kill cockroaches with, and we were spraying our legs and arms just out of desperation. I think that was probably, and the toilets had a series of snakes that were in there. And to get to the toilet at night was also a mission, because, you know, you'd walk through barefoot to whatever, and there would be all sorts of creepy crawlies, like scorpions and whatever. It was just, it was a nightmare. And that was an absolute baptism by fire. So that was definitely the worst. I think the wildest experience, the same area, you know, we've been continuing working in this area for quite some time. The same area, we're working on the small little lake system now. And I'm intrigued as to kind of understand its evolution, because I think it was a very large lagoon system in the past, as big as this one just to the south called Lake St. Lucia, which is quite a famous, some people say it's the biggest estuary in Africa. And I think there was a similar system to the north that probably even connected to St. Lucia. And I was doing some ground penetrating radar, because I'm quite keen to join up what you see in the terrestrial environment with what's then submerged in these kind of lagoons. And I was walking along a spit because I was just interested to see what that spit internal stratigraphy looks like. And I walk down to the water's edge, and there's all these reeds right there. As I get to the water's edge, and I've got the whole kit tied onto me and I'm pulling it along, this hippo just crashes out of these reeds. Must have been, I would say, about a meter away, this giant mouth opening, just snapping at me. And needless to say, I think I lost about 4 to 6 years of my life from that experience. And we actually had a ranger with us, but the ranger doesn't have a rifle. He's got like a little pistol, like a 9mm or whatever. I don't think that's going to do much to a hippo. And this thing just leapt out of the water. Obviously, it was just to scare us off. Apparently, what they do is they sit along the reeds and they stop the juvenile males going in, because they don't want them to breed with the female population. And I think it might have thought, to my immense size, because, you know, COVID also hasn't helped with that, it might have thought that perhaps I was a juvenile hippo, which is unkind, making my way to the water's edge there. And I think that was the closest I've come to death. The only other time was we were seismic profiling in one of these lagoon systems, and we went over a hippo and that chased us. And that was also quite close. But, mostly to do with hippos. After, what is it, the mosquito, they're the second most dangerous animal in Africa. I think humans come in third.
That's amazing. I have to say that before my trip to South Africa, when you organized ICS in 2014, I always thought that hippos were kind of cute, you know, and then you heard all of the stories. There's like, ooh, no, no. Okay. Do you have a favorite fieldwork place?
So yes, absolutely. It's kind of funny, you know, I must be a masochist, but I honestly think my best place for fieldwork are these lake systems along our northeast coast. For all of the, you know, the pterodactyl mosquitoes coming in, and the hippos and the crocodiles, It has been a place of such fantastic adventure. I've taken so many students there. I often take them on their own little our fourth year sedimentology field trip, just to give them some experience. Because a lot of our students also come from very disadvantaged backgrounds. They've never been to a place where there's like a game reserve that you can see hippos and elephants walking around. And the fieldwork these places has been intense, but I think most good fieldwork usually is intense. But at the same time, it's just been so rewarding. I mean, the things we've seen and the cool things we've done, and this is South Africa too. So there's no such thing as occupational health and safety. You're just out there on your own, and you know, things happen and you make a plan. And that's, you have to be quite resilient. And the resilience, you know, that my colleagues have demonstrated in some things where we've lost pieces of the coring equipment or something's exploded has been so cool. And, you know, it's left me with the most fondest memories of these places where we've worked. You know, nothing better than a day of hard fieldwork. You've got your core, but you've been bitten by 10 million horseflies and you've dodged a few hippos. And you come back to where you're staying. You put on a fire because you're going to have a good, we call it a braai here. You're going to have a good barbecue. And you just sit in the swimming pool and you crack open a beer and you're all forgiven. Those are fantastic. So, you know, I mean, and I've done all of my degrees from my honors, my fourth year undergrad degree through to my master's, through to my PhD. They've all been in that same area, obviously in different geographical locations, but within that same strip of about 100 kilometers south of the Mozambican border. And I mean, fantastic, just fantastic memories, you know, and I would recommend to anybody, perhaps not to go there to do field work, but certainly to go on a holiday. It's just in a World Heritage site. There's not a lot of people around. It's safe. It's secure. It's just, yeah, it's a real experience.
You will have to tell us which accommodation not to go to, though. I am a bit scared of the next question, Andy. What is the strangest thing that you have seen at the coast?
Okay, so I've seen some unusual things. Mostly the strangest things actually have to do with my students and their behaviors. So I don't think we need to go into those details. I think some of the strangest natural phenomena are things like crocodiles swimming in the ocean. And now bear in mind, we don't have saltwater crocodiles. We have freshwater crocodiles. But there was a point in time where some of these coastal lakes, the water levels were so low. We have obviously quite an extreme climate here. You know, it's burst and bloom. It's wet and it's dry and there's no uniformity. So we have these extreme droughts and we had hippos and crocodiles actually climbing out of the lake to go swim in the ocean because the ocean was less saline than the lake systems. I thought that was very, very unusual. Once or twice being out to sea surveying and we nearly ran over a whale. I think that was also quite interesting. You know, this the whale popped straight out as we were on a line with the flukes going and there was emergency evasive maneuvers. But usually just to do with the wildlife. I think that was quite unusual looking at a hippo in the ocean and crocodiles body surfing. You know, that was, I think, something that's quite unique to the coastline here. Not as good as, I think Andrew Cooper told me a story. They saw elephants on the beach in Gabon. I think that would have been quite cool. But yeah, those for me, I think, are the unusual highlights of things.
Okay. Let's go back to science. Did you think that we can predict long-term morphodynamic changes beyond the caudal scales?
So I think this is a question that is quite close to my heart. I'm not a morphodynamicist, of course. I deal more so with probably the centennial to millennial scale stratigraphic record. And so one of the things I'm really interested in is trying to bridge that gap between morphodynamics, stratigraphy, and kind of what then comes in the future. So we have this IGCP project, IGCP 725, which is trying to help address some of these issues in terms of bringing together modelers and stratigraphers and geomorphologists to bridge this gap, to start to push things, forecast coastal change, not just at the decadal scale, but into the centuries or perhaps even into the millennia. And I think this is very pressing because of the impending changes to the climate that we're facing, sea level rise, storminess, those sorts of things. How we'll do this, I don't know. It's quite difficult because from what I see, we have two camps in the world. We have the modelers, and then we have the guys that do the geomorphology, stratigraphy side of things. And oftentimes we don't know the same language. We don't talk to each other in a way in which I think it becomes mutually beneficial. You know, and you have to, you know, often hear of someone saying they're going to secure a modeler to help them with something in their paper. And I think, you know, we should all be working towards the same aims. We should be talking the same languages. I think when you have that down, and hopefully our IGCP meetings will start to bridge these gaps. When that's down, I think, yes, this should come about. I think, you know, the advances, things like AI and machine learning, and in particular, the sort of the broadening of skill sets, not just I'm a very niche modeler, I'm a very niche geomorphologist, I'm a very niche stratigrapher. I think all of those can start to be blurred somewhat in terms of boundaries. And I think, yes, definitely with the aid of things like machine learning in particular, this is something that can happen. I mean, I saw a fantastic paper at this conference just last week. It was the UK Coasts meeting. And Andy Plater gave this fantastic talk on using radar and XBeach or Delph 3D. It was a series of modeling that the guys had been doing over many, many years to understand changes in coastal morphology. I think it was the entrance to Liverpool Harbour. It was for shipping traffic and shipping hazards. But, you know, you could apply this to anywhere in the world, understanding these changes and then inputting it into a machine learning package to then produce what is predicted changes will be. And these predicted changes are obviously at the very short term. I mean, they're only like a sort of a week, which is what you need when you're wondering about ship traffic hazards. But I don't see why this can't, with increasing amount of input into the learning algorithms, produce something that can be forward modeled. And I would hope that we reach the century scale in my lifetime or within my working lifetime at least. And I would presume that 100 years or so, maybe more, we'll be getting to the millennial scale, which I think is exactly what we need to start trying to bridge. Because, you know, we're constantly looking at these paleo sea levels, but we know that sea levels be changing in later years. And we need to try and bridge the gap between, you know, the past and the future, not just, you know, the present being the key to the past, which is what brought me all the way through to geology in the first place.
Our next question is about a major advance in coastal science that will happen in the next 50 years. Do you think that you can think of something revolutionary in 50 years, or do you have a particular wish list?
So I think that just follows on almost immediately from the previous question. Honestly think that something like machine learning is going to become bigger and bigger. And with that, and artificial intelligence as well, with that, I think we're going to be able to start predicting with a relatively high degrees of certainty, very high resolutions, kind of coastal changes over the decadal scale going forward, even towards the century scale. I'm sure that in 50 years time, at that point, I will be 93 and probably a long gone memory and at that point, hopefully, you know, no one needs to live past 90, I don't think. But I'm certain that will be the case. And I think that will be revolutionary because that's going to allow us to manage coast properly. At this point in time, I think, at least in South Africa, I think a lot of what our coastal management entails is just almost playing a game of pin the tail on the donkey. You know, you're just guessing. We don't have background data. We have no real understanding of the major forcing mechanisms that drive coastal change here. We're still trying to pick that all up. You know, we're in the revolutionary phase now in terms of coastal geology, coastal geomorphology, whereas I think a lot of the world is in its mop-up phase of, you know, just tying up the last few loose ends. So for us, I think that's going to go a very, very, very long way in terms of helping us manage coastal resources. That I think that will be our big revolution.
Okay, the next question is about other contributions that you might do to society. What did you that you do through your work or not? Did you do mentoring, outreach, science communication?
So I think one of my greatest contributions is, you know, making sure that no beer goes undrunk in the South African breweries industry. No, I'm joking. Of course not. I think it's incredibly important to do outreach in terms of several different levels, going to schools. As I said, this is not something that is a very publicly, you know, people are not aware of what coastal geology or marine geology are about. You know, I'm constantly mistaken for a biologist, which is infuriating because I have absolutely no idea of statistics. So I could never be a biologist. But, you know, if we go from schools, it's very good to broadcast this message, to tell people that there are careers available in coastal geology, geomorphology, marine geology, all the way through to, you know, community service, such as reviewing papers. At one point, and you will understand, you're in the same situation. I was at one point the editor-in-chief of Geomarine Letters, and I'm very glad to see that you've taken over. You've taken on the baton from me. I think that too is a fairly large community service. It's a difficult job, very useful for learning about the publishing industry, but at the same time, extremely time-consuming. It can be rewarding at times, at other times not, but I think things like reviewing and editing are critical in a time in which I think peer review is increasingly threatened. So I think that too is a fairly big outreach. Over and above that too, I think geoscience education just as a whole is something that I'm quite into. My wife is very into that. And so by proxy, I'm along. And so it's things like geoheritage, getting, you know, South Africa's got beautiful sites that are very relevant, not just from coastal geology, but all the way through to ancient geology, 3 billion year old rocks. And it's pretty cool to be able to be involved with that. You know, public here has to understand that geoscience is not just about mining. It's about all sorts of interesting things that you can actually just enjoy. You know, you can go and look at something and be amazed at it for its natural, I guess, it, you know, its natural beauty and its natural meaning. It's not just about ore extraction. So I've quite enjoyed being involved with that too. I'm not sure if I'm missing out on anything. We might have to circle back to that one. Sorry, Anna.
That's okay. So we're going towards our last question. That is, what was the best or worst advice that you ever received? Or another way to think about it is, what would you say to your former self?
Okay, that's a good one. I think, you know, again, can I split this into two answers, a personal and a professional? So on the personal side of things, we have a son and he was born profoundly deaf. And if anyone listens to this and they can hear this message, I'll be very grateful. A lot of people, you know, we were worried he hadn't started talking by 1 year old. And a lot of people are like, no, it comes. Don't worry. He's a boy. They develop slower and he'll get it. He'll talk. And it was only just out of frustration at about just probably a month or two before his second birthday, where we actually had to have a very complicated hearing test. And it turned out that he's profoundly deaf. And if there's one thing I really wish that was the worst advice, and it is, if someone could take good advice from me now, it would be, if those are the sorts of things that you're worried about, it's not a deal to go and have it tested. Go and look at it, you know, whether it's something about your kid's hearing or any form of development. You know, time is short. You've got that very small window to do these sorts of things, remedial things. And I would really, really, I really wish I had have ignored people. And I wish I'd have done that sooner. That's the only thing, really, from a personal side of things. From a professional side of things, you know, I've received a lot of advice. I actually have forgotten the bad advice. I think I've just picked up mostly the good advice over the time. So, you know, I don't want to think of things negatively. I don't want to think back on my life and go, oh, I wish I had changed something professionally. I mean, I am where I am because of all of the bits of advice, both good and bad. But, you know, the great advice that I've had over the years has been from my former boss, who was a very, very, very warm, very inviting and kind person. And he would always tell me to be strategic, to think strategically about things in the long run. How do I take this data set, say, and what will this data set furnish me as we move forward and into the future? You know, is it a small paper? Can this be combined with other data sets into a bigger paper? You know, he was very, very good like that. And I have always thought as strategically as possible. Then, of course, you know, I've got the good life advice from wonderful friends like Andrew Cooper, or, you know, Edward Anthony, who have been so kind over the years when I've reached out, because there's no one really here to advise me. I do the advising in South Africa on most things to do with the field. So, you know, I've asked them many times to help me to benchmark where I sit and, you know, am I doing okay? Am I not doing okay? You know, you have the imposter syndrome that peeps its head in every now and again. And, you know, their advice has always been amazing. It's just, you know, to stick with things, to nurture good relationships with colleagues and to just kind of put your head down and don't sweat the small stuff. Just focus on the big things. And I think that has been life-changing. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I like that. Okay. Before going to our final quick questions, is there something that you would like to say today that you haven't had a chance to say through the questions?
Well, I think it's just, and I probably have touched on this, but you know, it's a small world and South Africa is a small place in the small world. And, you know, we're looking obviously to increase capacity and development here in terms of what is, in my opinion, a critically scarce skill, this idea of coastal marine science, geoscience, let's call it a blanket term. And to do that, you know, there needs to be collaborations. There need to be mentors that come in that are not just me, you know. Likewise to my students, you know, they look at me as one person that pretty much controls all of the things that they associate with. And to have other people come and to visit and to exchange ideas, I think is really good, because then it also allows them to contextualize that they're getting a good education. What they're doing is equally as good as anyone else in the world, even despite the lack of resources and the challenging conditions that we face. So that's it. It's just to, you know, I would call on collaborations, but meaningful collaborations, not the parachute science that we know is rife across the globe. And, you know, to strengthen things here, I would love to see that happen. And to, of course, to grow the science, not just from my university, but across all the universities in the country.
I wish that happened, Sandy. Okay, so now our final quick questions, just to wrap up. Don't think too much. Give me your first answer, okay? First one, favorite band, music, or composer?
Ooh, I really like a band called Thrice. Yeah, so I'm quite into them. They're just a one-time punk rock band and now just a sort of a normal rock band. But yeah, I've been listening to them quite a bit lately.
Cool. Favorite dish? Or signature dish?
Steak. Brazilian style steak from a churrascaria, without a doubt.
The latest book you have read?
The Bummer Mafia by Malcolm Gladwell.
The weirdest thing on your desk right now?
You're going to laugh, but a can of mosquito spray.
He has a problem with mosquitoes. Okay. Favorite movie?
Ooh. I haven't watched a movie in so long, because that's what happens when you have little kids. But I think it's a tie between Ghostbusters, the original, not the remake, that was awful. Ghostbusters, the original, and then the movie, that horror movie, Event Horizon. I thought that was pretty cool.
Okay. Coffee or tea?
Tequila. No, kidding. I much prefer tea. Tea is the way forward. I can't drink coffee.
Okay, you have mentioned beer several times. Do you have a favorite beer?
I do enjoy, actually, to be honest, I was turned onto a delicious beer. It was called Lamp Ale, and that was in this little pub called the Victoria in Durham. So that's where we had this UK Coast meeting this last week. And I quite enjoyed that. But, you know, just as a normal drinking beer, there's a beer in Namibia. It's called Hansa. You can only get it on tap. So it's a draft beer. And, you know, we were stuck in Namibia last year. We got COVID and we were stuck there. We went for what was supposed to be a 2-week holiday and spent a month. And once the COVID subsided, there was nothing better. You know, we were all staggered because one person got sick than the next. So myself and my brother-in-law were the first few that were sick. So when everyone else was basically down and out, we'd walk down and we'd have these ice cold Hansa beers on tap sitting there. It was wonderful. And I think those are fantastic. If anyone goes to Namibia, you can get those. You can just icy cold. They're in a frozen mug, scorching hot. It's just the absolute best. So yes, I would completely recommend that.
Fantastic. And the message to the beer makers is that if their profits go over the roof because of our amazing podcast, we are welcome.
Okay. Yes, royalties are welcome, please.
Thank you very much, Andy, for your time today. It's been a lot of fun. And thank you, everyone, for following us in one more episode of Coast to Cast. I hope you have enjoyed it. Please follow us and give us many, many stars when you review us. Thank you. Bye.